everybody. Welcome to Who Cares About the Rock Hall, a podcast about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm your host, Joe Quazala. With me, as always, is my co-host, Kristen Studdard.
If you can believe it.
Yeah, we are back, in a sense.
It's happening.
Not exactly business as usual, but we have not recorded with a guest in quite a while. And now we're doing it via Zoom. I might as well just bring him in. He is a previous guest. We're so happy to have him back. He is a music journalist, has written a book about NWA, currently writing a book about Whitney Houston, and was on the show advocating for Janet Jackson. It's Garrett Kennedy.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we're so excited to talk to you. We have not talked to you since Janet was inducted.
I know. Lifetime ago, right?
Right.
Or so it feels.
Probably 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And when we talked to you, it was she had been nominated for the third time, but it was still, you know, a question of whether it felt really dicey.
Yeah.
It felt like, you know, how many times she'd been snubbed, but then she finally got in.
She went all the way.
Justice for Janet was redeemed. It really, truly was.
Did you see her induction?
I did. I did watch the ceremony. I usually don't watch them. I think we've had this conversation.
Hey, same.
But I did watch it. I was, you know, really interested to see what she was going to say, given all that she had gone through, given all that is attached to the family name. I think that's pretty obvious what I'm talking about. And then also just to see, I was disappointed that there was no performance. I thought there was a missed opportunity there, especially because from a performing perspective, she has gotten that credit in the last 5 or 6 years, I think, from the public in a way that it would have been really nice to see her on that stage. But those politics, I certainly was not surprised to see that there was then not a performance because, you know, having written the book on NWA and having talked to Cube and just knowing, you know, a lot of the issues that go into trying to appease everybody for that performance, it just was probably not going to happen for Team Janet. So I understood.
Well, and they were gearing up for her Vegas residency, you know, and so probably the production, our guess was that the production values that were required for a true Janet Jackson extravaganza were probably a little more than the
Absolutely.
Wee little Rock Hall could
and
give.
I was at that opening night in Vegas, and it was everything I needed
to be.
And then some.
I thought her speech was really great at the induction. I like that she called out Terry and Jimmy Jam and
who were in the audience.
And did that make the broadcast? I can't remember.
I think it did.
She had them like stand up. She really paid respect to everyone who had helped her get where she was, but then also really stood up and was like, we need to induct more women.
Yeah.
They definitely did not listen, but it was a very lovely speech. It was interesting too, like kind of how she handled the family stuff. There were some things in there that I was like, okay.
Well, we were on the edge of our seats.
Yeah.
Like, is she going to mention Michael? Is she going to mention her father? And she did mention Joe Jackson. It did get a little uncomfortable.
It's hard because I also, as much as I love Janet for a long time, and as much as my love for Michael was changed by leaving Neverland and all of these things happening around the same time and covering it. And, you know, one of the things that came up was sort of the relationship with the fact that it's Rock Hall and that this does air on HBO and that HBO did play this documentary and that HBO was in the midst of this strange lawsuit that doesn't actually make any sense. And so this idea that if it aired someplace else, she might have shown up differently. She might have said something differently. She might have been different. And I just don't think that to be true. I don't think there was anything about, you know, this airing on HBO, which is how this is the way that she changed her speech or made a decision to not perform or all those things. I just don't think are necessarily true. But it was something that was in the back of my mind because I thought about how so much of the conversation had been around this idea that we're not allowed to talk about this, which I think is incorrect. And I think that you know, Michael is a great example of what do we do when we have to come to a reckoning with how we feel about someone, how we feel about what they were able to accomplish, but also the things that they were alleged to have done. And so there was so many ways to think about it. And there's lots of ways, you know, some of which I won't even say here, where I've had a hard time. I've had a hard time loving Janet, and then also kind of also loving the fact that my brain somehow is wired to just start asking these questions in my mind. And I'm just like, so, you know, as a sibling, I wonder, like, there was never a conversation. There was never a, this feels weird. There was never anything. I think some of it, I don't know. I don't know what to do with it. And this is me as a fan who loves these, but I'm just like, what do you do as the sibling? And now you are expected to say something. You're expected to acknowledge your brother. You're expected to acknowledge the history that you most certainly stand upon and are a part of, but how do you do all that while ignoring the other side of it that at that time was very, very, very loud?
Yeah, you know, I hadn't even, and maybe this is just me being myopic, but like I hadn't even thought about the HBO connection between the documentary and the Rock Hall, and as it being the outlet for that programming, and it hadn't even occurred to me.
Part of what I've always been so fascinated by that family is the dynamic, and it is. I mean, because we also have to remember there was such a point for a long time where Michael didn't speak to any of them. He lived in his own world. It was what it was. You know, we kind of saw it, but we never really reckoned with what that might have been like or felt like. And I don't think we're ever really going to truly know. I don't see there being a day where, you know, Janet is talking about the years where it's like,
oh yeah, I don't see her suddenly becoming a not private person.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder how much of that privacy is because of what that was and because of what, you know, that life had to have been. I mean, it has to be a challenge. It has to be even, yeah, I'm going to always want to believe my sibling, my parent, my partner, my friend, whoever, that they did not do something that they're accused of, particularly if the thing they're accused of is like, is as heinous as it is. It's a hard place to sit. And I think what we're seeing with Janet is someone who is sitting in that space the best you can, which is like, it's still my sibling, but like, am I going to be doing a bunch of interviews being like, he didn't do it? No. You know, because what good does that do me? And what good does that do the conversation? And like, you know, maybe it's something where we don't know how she truly feels about some of this stuff. And I don't think it definitely is not our business, but I don't think we're ever going to know. And we have to make a decision of how we feel about that.
I will say too, in her speech, and Joe kind of alluded to this too, she really went in on how great Joe Jackson was. That was a surprise to me, just maybe because I only know the kind of salacious stereotype of their
childhood. TV movie version.
Yeah, I know. I guess it's like without Joe Jackson, you don't have all of
you don't have any
stuff,
of it.
You know?
You don't have any of it. And, you know, Joe was difficult because, like, surprised, like most Black kids growing up in the hood, like spankings were part of your life. There's definitely a line between that where it easily veers into abuse, and he crossed that line very much with those kids. I've thought a lot about, you know, what it must have been to have this dream of wanting to get out of the ghetto. And I mean, this is something I read about in the book I'm writing now, Whitney, which is, you know, what we're here to talk about, of
course. We will get to it.
I promise. And it all makes sense because it's all connected, because at one point I do write about Sissy and Joe together. And I think it's important because it's the same school of thought, which is I see this greatness in my children, for the case of Joe, and I want to get them there by any means necessary. And I don't agree with the fact that, you know, when we're thinking about particularly Michael, because obviously he's the youngest at the time in the group, yes, it's inappropriate to have them in the clubs performing. They're seeing vaudeville acts, they're seeing burlesque shows, they're seeing all the stuff they shouldn't be seeing, obviously, as young kids. But just this idea of you have to be 100 times greater than everyone else, even though your natural ability is already 100 times greater. Just that idea that he was instilling in them, yeah, you can't take that away. You can't take away the hardness of your voice is great, you can dance, you want to do this, I see you have an interest. Some of it, yes, is me like wanting to live vicariously through you, so I'm pushing you harder. But there's the other side of it, of like trying to make a dream happen under circumstances where it's like not even at all close to a reality. Just the idea of getting out of Gary and then making it to Motown is like crazy. It's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy if any of you, if you've ever gone to Gary, you know, I remember begged my parents to like take me to the Jackson House, and I needed to see this house and I needed to see this neighborhood. And, you know, my mom, you know, one of her childhood friends moved to Gary. And so she's like, sure. So we did it. My parents like made this detour, took me there. And it was hard. I mean, because I'm like, I lived in the ghetto, but I was like, I guess I don't, because you know what I mean?
Like, you were like, I thought I did,
but I legitimately did not. Like, I didn't live, we were in an apartment and it was like, oh, you have sheet as curtains. Like, it was a level of poverty that I was not accustomed to. I was accustomed to like, yeah, people were broke and yeah, people were trying to make ends meet, but it wasn't this. And this was so incredibly painful to see. And I remember having my own reaction that I was internalizing, but I was watching my mom. And I was watching my mom, who, you know, obviously she is an adult. And so she's seeing her friend live in circumstances that still didn't, it was still so far away from what they were used to, what obviously I was used to. And that was really hard. And that was, you know, five blocks from the Jackson Family House. And so I think about that, and that was, it's probably in the 90s, you know, when we did that trip. And so I think about what that was like in the 60s and the 50s. And it's just, yeah, some of it I get. I don't agree with it, but some of it I definitely get. And I saw the same thing, you know, with Sissy, where it's that idea of like, it's teaching your child, A, you are going to have to work so much harder already because of where you're from, because of what you look like, because of the color of your skin. It's all, you're already going to have to do 3, 4, 5 times as much work. So I might as well just make you do it now. Like, I get the logic of it. I got, like, I definitely got, like, okay, so you got them like doing rehearsals like 6 hours a day, every single day, and then doing school, and then come, you know, they have to come home from school, finish the rest of their rehearsal. Some of it I definitely understood. I don't agree with all of it, but I think that idea of that work ethic, so much of what the greatness of Janet and Michael.
And this is just also really giving me very, very much Beyonce vibes.
Very much Beyonce. Very much Beyonce.
Like, incredibly similar. Very much.
I mean, we hear about, you know, Matthew having Destiny's Child run laps in heels. Like, yes, it sounds abusive and like, okay, maybe it's not the greatest thing you could do to a child. But I think when you are training for greatness, I think if you looked at what Joe or Sissy were doing with their children, and then you look at what, think of like Venus Serena's dad, like if you think if you think about that level of conditioning, I don't see much of a difference. Of course, you know, obviously Joe, you're also having like a couple of ass whoopings in there on top of if you miss a dance step or if you miss a lyric, okay, you're about to get this belt, and that's not cool. But I just think of that element of training them like Olympic athletes, it really did make sense, and it makes all the difference. And you think about, you know, we think of our greats, they all kind of have that similar starts, and some of it has been a parent that pushed them, whether or not it might have been because the parent once upon a time wanted to like be in the industry and failed, and now they see, you know, a chance through their child. Sure, that's probably true. It most certainly is true in the case of Joe and Sissy. But I think that element of, you know, the work ethic, it showed off, and you can still see that, like, that's what sticks. That's what sticks with Janet. That's what sticks with her when she talks about him.
I think that is, yeah, that's a great point to even contextualize it. And so Whitney is getting in.
Yes.
Which, no duh, come on. How did you feel?
You know, it's so interesting because so much of what I, in writing this book, and the insane amount of research that I've done for it. But so much of what I am trying to, I don't want to say course correct, because I don't think a book can do this. I don't think one thing can do this. But this idea that has stood with her is that Whitney was this empty vessel. She had zero control over the music that she made. She didn't write any of it. She didn't produce it in a traditional sense. And so therefore she's not an artist. Therefore she's not a musician. And I have always been challenged by that belief, because we see it with Beyonce too, but somehow the conversation is eluded from someone like Adele, but I don't know what's different.
What could possibly be
different between Adele and Beyonce and Whitney, but it just that idea that because you're not writing, because you're not making the composition around the music that you're singing, then therefore you're not an artist. And so much of what I've been trying to like fight against as I've been writing this is like making my way through the criticism of that criticism. Right. And so that idea that because those things were not true, then it takes away from her artistry. And that to me, I've always disagreed with. And why I disagree with it is because of the fact that every single song we heard of Whitney, yes, in her whole catalog, she's probably wrote like a handful. It's not that many that she has actually written herself. But the way that she sings every single song is
the Star-Spangled Banner.
Banner, you know,
is
you think of these
a moments. Whitney Houston song. Like that's a Whitney Houston song.
It's a Whitney like, song.
She got it on the charts
twice.
Who? Yeah, right after 9/11, and then went originally
twice.
Okay, so we say someone is not an excellent pianist if they play Beethoven the best. Do you know what I mean? Using your voice as an instrument, mm-hmm. like why do we not give that equal?
Yeah. And also, if you put it into the context of, say, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and you look at someone like Elvis Presley.
For example.
Write his songs.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's like,
and we're stealing them if we really need to be honest about it.
Yeah, right. Yes. Major appropriation, famously. You start to question then, okay, well, what's going on here when we apply this criticism that we don't to our alleged gods and kings mm-hmm. of whether it's the institution of Rock Hall or it's music in general?
Was that in a dream? I'm sorry.
where are we going with this?
Oh my God. I think it really might have been in a dream, or it's in a show.
Okay. You say your truth.
Where everybody is lip syncing. I think it was on Pose, where someone lip syncs Whitney Houston doing the Star Spangled Banner.
Oh yes, that's Pose.
It is in Pose. Okay, I was like, mm-hmm. it's either in a TV show or a dream, but I can't believe this would be in a TV show, so it felt like a dream. But Pose mm-hmm. is kind of a dream of a TV show in some ways.
Right.
I had been on my mind recently because I just finished the second season. Someone lip syncs Whitney Houston doing the Star Spangled Banner, and it's like really great.
Mm-hmm. Garrick, let's talk about Whitney Houston, and let's talk about, first I want to start with your connection to Whitney. I know she's such an ever-present figure. Do you remember the first time you heard Whitney?
So that's a hard question, because it blurs together for me watching the videos on MTV. But I do remember very clearly when I truly fell in love with Whitney, and that was watching The Bodyguard. I loved the music. Pretty much like everybody else, like every other kid who liked pop music. But so much of what I enjoyed in my childhood was TV, films, music. Pretty solid nerd stuff. And The Bodyguard was the first time that I had seen music and film come together in a way that spoke to me. And so I begged my stepmom to take me to see it. I begged. And so, you know, she took me. I'm seeing this movie, and it's the scene when Rachel, the character, is singing Run to You. And she is legitimately running in heaven, and there was something about it that felt so magical to my young mind that I was then a bigger fan walking out of that than when I started. Because, you know, at the time it was like, you've seen a couple music videos, but at that point when she came out, I was already a couple years old. So it was like, I didn't enter a world and then discover Whitney Houston. She was already there for me. Mm-hmm. So listening to it on MTV or whatever was always fun. And like the videos were great, but it was The Bodyguard. And it was the fact that that film felt so special to me, that soundtrack felt so special to me. And it was, yeah, that and I'm Your Baby Tonight were like my two.
Oh, I'm Your jams. Baby Tonight.
What was the decision to take on Whitney as the next subject of your book?
You know, the decision to actually do it, it's tough because like before I decided to actually write the proposal, I spent 5 years being like, I kind of want to do something. I don't really know. It started with me working through my own grief of, you know, the first time I met Whitney was 2 days before she passed. So
whoa.
I had this heaviness over me. It's really hard to talk about. It's also hard to like get into when it's like, oh, I haven't written that part of the book yet. But
yeah, sure.
All of it started with that idea of getting back to like my love of her, because it was her passing was very different from when we lost Michael, when we lost Prince, when we lost Amy. I was able to just be a fan and grieve, but this thing hit me first of like a human being that I spent time with 2 days before. It didn't matter that they were superstar. It was a human being that I spent time with 2 days before, barely 2 days before, and now gone. That was really traumatic. It was really traumatic for me. I was a young reporter, you know, when it happened. So all of that, you know, and it was something where it was like, once she passed, once and all, you know, that I had mentioned that I had was around her in this other piece because a piece was on Brandy and Monica. And so, and that was at the Beverly Hilton. And so, you know, once that was then mentioned, it's like, you know, I have to write the piece of like, whatever, what happened that day? What was going on? What was she like? You know, all of those things that were obviously really clear because of course you meet Whitney Houston. I spent the whole weekend telling everybody in my family, like, I just met Whitney Houston, and like also other things were going on and they were not great. And so, you know, that's the story that like, you know, I told my mom the story, I told my editor the story. But then of course I'm not going to tweet, oh, it was this or, you know, and even the piece that I wrote about the rehearsal that she came in on, and like, I think the language that we chose to go with was like, she was very lively, because again, it was something of wanting to respect the fact that I was not writing a story about her, wanting to respect the fact that I was privy to someone in a state that they were not also then privy to the fact that I was a reporter. And so it didn't feel good. So I was like, at the time I was like, yeah, we don't need to mention any of that. The day that she passed though, it's obviously, as we're trying to piece the story together, it wasn't right. And this is the conversation I had with my editor at the time, where it's like, you now have a responsibility to write what you saw, because this is the thing that happened. And this is the thing that happened at the Beverly Hilton, and you were there, and you were there 2 days before. So wrote that piece, then have to like do a million interviews. So like, I'm sure in some weird pockets of YouTube, you can see me on Today's Show or Dateline or 2020 or something. Like I legitimately like spent the next 2 weeks just doing press, which was very weird.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
It was a very weird experience. So for a long time, I didn't listen to her music. I didn't watch her movies. I didn't do any of it. It was a complete opposite of when Amy passed or when Prince passed, where it's like, I just was listening to it all just to get through, to make sense of it. But this was like, I completely divorced myself of Whitney for quite a long time. And then her daughter passed away. And I remember thinking how fucking tragic this is. How tragic this entire scope of the story is. And then I started to think about our own implications of it. I started to think about our own involvement. All of our jokes over the years, crack is whack, all the things that we did and that we said. And, you know, even when it got really ugly, where it was like, I remember a time where like you would go and see the National Enquirer and it would be like, she's only got 10 days to live. Like it got to a place where it was so incredibly over the top. It's a level of behavior that we would not at all do. I think Britney's the last person that we really did this to, where it was like, we actually are waiting for you to die and we want you to remind you that we're waiting for you to die. So we're going to write every element of every single time that we write about you about like, well, we think that this might be it. Oh yeah, we think this might be the one. Oh yeah, you sneezed. Maybe you'll OD'd. You know, just this element of nastiness that was attached to to Whitney. I started to think about that a lot. And then there was a Lifetime movie. Angela Bassett did it. I thought it was okay. I didn't think it was terrible. I thought it was okay. But I started to just think a little bit more about, okay, the legacy is starting to feel not what I like it to be, what I would like it to be as a fan, what I would like it to be as someone who respects this woman, but also who thinks about all that comes from Whitney. Just what she did with the Star Spangled Banner and I Will Always Love You, and how that introduced a way of singing a song, and how I can't name any pop artist that sings that is not directly connected to Whitney's voice, that does not try to mimic her approach. Talk about melisma, and we talk about these things that she popularized. I mean, I started to really, really think all these different thoughts that I had about Whitney and the way that I would just talk about her in passing with friends, or when I would really nerd out and be like, oh my God, can you believe 1998 and My Love Is Your Love? And like, that was also the year that we got Never Say Never. And that was also the year that we got Deborah Cox, and that we got Tamia, and that we got Kelly Price, and that we got all these women who were so very much like part of the core of who Whitney was, but that she also lifted up and held, because one of the things that she never gets credit for is just her role of R&B's auntie is a good way to think about her, mm-hmm, and just how she kind of uplifted so many women who, yes, they came after her, but also very much showed, we want to carry your tradition. We love you. It was never this weird competition thing. They really only did it with Mariah, but people forget that they had a friendship for decades, you know? So I started thinking of all these other ways in which we don't talk about Whitney, which we don't celebrate Whitney. And I was like, is there a book there? And so it did start kind of with this idea of like, oh, we'll do a bio. And I just didn't feel like the world needed another biography on Whitney Houston. Mm-hmm. I thought that there had been so many. My opinion on those don't matter. I've read them all. Mm-hmm. My opinion on those don't matter. Because again, I think when you're talking about writing a bio on somebody, it's a lot of heavy lifting in a particular way that I just didn't think was necessary anymore, because there were two great documentaries that came out on Whitney, one of which was sanctioned by the estate, but the other started with something that she wanted to do and started with, you know, her giving clearance to the filmmaker, let's film this whole tour. It was, you know, the biggest tour of her career, but it was also kind of the last hurrah for her in so many ways. But when the director was like, so people are concerned and they have questions about some of the missed shows, this might actually be the reason, or people are saying this, and you know, it came up of like, I do want to talk about other stuff, namely drugs. And she's like, what drug problem? There's no drug problem. And so, the filmmaker was like, I don't feel right to continue to do a film and then we not talk about this other part of your life that is so very clearly being represented in other ways. It's there even if we're not talking about it. And so I looked at those two films and I love them both. And I looked at those two and I said, well, what if I just wrote something that was the way that I think about Whitney? I think somebody might be interested in it, because I don't think that everybody connects the dots the way that I do, because I obsess about Whitney. I obsess about her voice. I obsess about all of the people who love her and who have tried to mimic her in some way or fashion. So that's where it started.
Why don't we take a quick break? And then when we come back, we will really get into Whitney and the induction. So we'll be right back. Welcome back to the show, everybody. We hope you had a nice break. We hope during your break,
you remembered something that brought you joy during this pandemic.
Yes, we hope that for you. And if you didn't, try harder next time. So, Garrick, we were talking about your book and how it's not a traditional biography of Whitney Houston. I'm curious, are you much of a character in the book?
So outside of the first chapter, which, you know, was really kind of me setting up what I want this book to be, which really is a roadmap. It's a roadmap to memory and to loss and to triumph. It's a celebration of her. It's a celebration of pop music. It's a celebration of R&B, very specifically 90s R&B. So myself as a character doesn't exist in the way of, you know, I'm connecting to everything. So it's not me in every chapter, but the first chapter, yes, I do tell the story of, you know, falling in love, you know, with her and the bodyguard. I connected back to, you know, the same year that she passed. I took this trip, this Eat, Pray, Love trip, basically. I took this trip to Europe and I got lost in London and I wound up, and this is very strange, but I literally wound up in front of a theater that was putting on a musical of the bodyguard that I had never heard of. And so I write about that. And then I write about even how long it took me to, because I didn't see it then because I didn't feel right. It felt like, why does this exist? But it wasn't until probably like 5 or 6 years later when it came, the show came to LA and Deborah Cox was the star. And I know Deborah Cox, love and respect of Whitney, but also she is one of few singers who legitimately can actually mimic Whitney in such a really powerful way that I'm like, and now I need to go see it. So that's probably the most personal that is the most personal that I get. I know at some point I need to write about, you know, that weekend.
Yeah. Which, mm-hmm.
Toward the end. But it really is, you know, me connecting all these dots. I spent a whole chapter on Sissy and on gospel music and, you know, going in Sissy's past, because I think so much of even how we have talked about Sissy over the years is like, yeah, she does gospel great and she's a stage mom, but like no one really sits with that first part of like, yeah, you're a gospel great, but from what cloth was she cut from? And my gosh, just that alone is like, there was no other choice for Whitney than greatness. You know, you think of her mom, you know, singing on the same bill as Mahalia Jackson at the 57 Newport Jazz Festival, which, you know, people who know gospel know that that is probably one of the most important moments for gospel at a time, because it helped move it to mainstream. It helped move it from the Chitlin' Circuit, quote unquote, as we say, to a really mainstream white space. Let's just be really clear. It moved it to a different space. And to see that Sissy was a part of that, that alone, yes, there's so much more, but just that one little piece alone has been so forgotten over time. We just saw, I don't know if anybody's been watching, you know, the Versus matchups, but we just saw, you know, Gladys and Patty.
Yeah.
Go toe to toe. But, you know, when it comes to Midnight Train to Georgia, at no point did anybody mention that Sissy did it before. Sissy did it before Gladys. And I think that these moments that have been so lost to time, but also lost to the fact of, yes, when you are the mother of Whitney Houston, like your accomplishments, they get minimized. You know what I mean? I hate to say it.
Yeah.
That it just happens. But I think that so much of our relationship with Sissy, and just I think about her on those Aretha records and on Elvis, and you know that those connections I wanted to make, because I wanted this to be really a reassessment of all the things that I believe that we missed the first time around. I think if we had a different relationship with, not I think, I know, if we had a different relationship with the way that we talk about sexuality, with the way that we talk about addiction, with the way that we talk about race, with the way that we talk about celebrity in America, everything would have been so different with Whitney. The way that we talked about her, wrote about her, thought about her, celebrated her would all be different. And so some of what we're seeing now is a course correction of that. But it's, you know, I don't like the fact that Whitney's not here for any of this. I don't like the fact that Whitney's not here in a moment where Janelle Monáe can exist and like
yes. open
this door of possibility for Black queer women everywhere. I don't like the fact that, you know, she's not here to see how far her voice carried pop and R&B. It's not an injustice because ultimately she's someone who died of her own actions, and that's something that I don't run from. But I do think that when we look at all of the ways in which she was broken and the way that we contributed to that, I ultimately think that, yeah, it does kind of suck that if maybe we were a little bit nicer, if maybe we were a little bit more understanding, or if maybe we didn't like make bets on her and Bobby, or if maybe we didn't like, you know, yes, it was very clear to see that there was this situation with her and, you know, this other woman and like, this obsession that happened, you know, in the early 90s over it. It's like, we wouldn't do that now. There's no star now that could walk out, and whether or not they want to confirm if they're in a same-sex relationship, you would not see an interviewer that's be like, okay, so are you gay or not? Or what? Are you with somebody? Yeah. So who are you sleeping with? Oh, no one? Oh, okay. So because she was making love songs and she refused to talk about who she was with, that added to it, right? That added to the way that she was treated, that added to the anger from press, that added to like the dismissal from critics and also from people who at a certain point did get tired. They got tired of the music. They got tired of these sweet love songs.
Sweet love songs. You know, well, I've been thinking about this a lot. How many celebrities in particular we could have that would have been so helped by the opening of our society with regards to sexuality and gender. Mm-hmm. I watched The Last Dance recently, and I've been thinking a ton about Dennis Rodman and how if he 20 years later was starting in the NBA, he would be able to be like a genderqueer fucking superstar.
Like champion. Yeah.
Champion. And,
yeah.
And he wouldn't have had to run to Las Vegas. He would never, he attempted suicide. You know what I mean? Like they talk about, he tried to kill himself because he was not free to be who he was. And he would overcompensate with all the drugs and the partying and the dating of Carmen Electra and all this shit, like this big facade, because we as a society were not ready for all that he was or is, you know? And it breaks my damn heart that this man almost killed himself because we aren't ready for him. Like, oh, and I think that, you know, with Whitney, it's like, if we had just given her a little more grace and space, she wouldn't have
Who knows?
Felt, right. You know, the... Like addiction is a coping mechanism. It's not like she just was having so much fun that she died. It is such a tragedy of kind of our society that we want what we want from people, and we only want them to be we see them. We want them to fit.
Yeah. The second that you can't hit that note the same way, it's we dispose of you. I mean, you think about, because the book did start with thinking about just maybe the last decade of her life, because that also fascinates me too. It fascinates me because so much of what she was doing was being a regular person, living a quiet life in Alpharetta, you know, with her daughter, not really doing this music thing. And so there's parts of that that does interest me, but I do think more about just that level of like, disposing of her because she couldn't hit that note, because she still couldn't sing I Will Always Love You the way she sang it in 91, 92, 93, 94, 95. Okay, well, at this point, we don't have anything else that we need from her. And so now it's like, well, you know, let's focus on this marriage that's probably not so great. You know, it just, there was this turn that we all did as a society with her because of the fact that she just doesn't quite sound the way that she's did it when she sang it the first go around, and then sang it every day for 4 years on tour and now, and then shot her voice because she was also smoking cigarettes or whatever. But like, just that alone, you know, we saw it a little bit with, you know, she's been able to get it back, but it was a long road for Mariah to get that back. And Mariah is still having to have this conversation with everybody, which is like, so you know, I write all these songs too. Like, she's still having to say it. She's still having to say it at this point. So so much of it is like, with this book, I really did just want to celebrate her in a way that I feel is still missing. It's one thing for Kaiga to be like, oh, I want to like do a remix and like it's great. And like, then we like love Whitney again, or we put Whitney in, you know, love Simon, and it's this nice, fabulous moment. And like, all these things are great, but I still think about how at that same time, Kanye still makes the decision of like, I want to spend all this money to get that picture from the National Enquirer to make that the cover of Pusha T's record. And like, I can't even go listen to the album now, because even if I enjoy Pusha T's music, I don't, what is it that you're communicating to me by putting the image of the drugged in, quote unquote, that we all saw? We all remember that moment, and we all remember how terrible it was that like her sister-in-law is the one who sold that picture. But like, what does that do for you as an artist to now have that as your album cover? Particularly if you are not going to have any conversation around addiction. You're not gonna have any, you know, what the drugs you sold in the same community, like what you think that might have done or not done. So, you know, it's just stuff like that where I think that there's still these cheap shots that happen.
Yes.
And it's not gonna stop. And I don't think that any of us writing anything, or us being on a podcast, or her going to the, you know, Rock and Hall of Fame is gonna change any of that. But I want it for myself. And I knew that, okay, if I think this way and I feel this way, people who are somewhat interested in her might read something and be like, I had no idea, or I didn't know that.
Do you know what you're going to call the book yet?
The book is called Exhale.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a great name.
That's a good title.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would you like to see happen in her Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction? Who's your like dream people? What's your dream? Okay, who are the dream performers who do the tribute? Mm. How does it build? How does it end? What kind of trio do we have doing harmony at the end? I think, okay, now I'm starting to fantasize.
Yeah. Now we're getting into show producing. I love it.
I'm like, it ends with I'm Every Woman, and it's every woman that performed the whole night, maybe. I don't know. I'm thinking. My love is your love.
There's two ways to think about this, because sadly we are not going to get a fully produced live induction ceremony for the first time. So like, there's a little bit of fantasy producing for what could have been, what was supposed to happen.
I just went back in time and was like,
back in time.
Literally,
your mind was erased of everything that has happened in the past 6 months.
Beyonce is out there, and literally then from the wings, Mariah, she floats, she's carried in by like six guys, she's doing a mermaid style, like, oh my God.
So this is
Alicia Keys on the piano.
Okay. This is a very different year, because they are going to produce some sort of special for HBO, but we don't know what that is going to look like. We have no information about what they're planning on doing. They're not calling it an induction ceremony, but it's going to be something to replace that live event that cannot happen this year.
Oh, they're not calling it an induction ceremony?
As far as I understand, but we don't know what's happening. It also feels like the production of live things and award shows is evolving as we get deeper into this. So, you know, if they had done this 5 months ago, it would have been probably a sad looking Zoom show. But now that we've seen, like, with the VMAs and other things, there are other possibilities. But what we can do is we can break down usually what we see with an induction, like who gives a speech.
Oh,
right.
Who do you think is going to be her? Who's going to induct her?
Right. So typically there's one person giving a speech at like a podium at the ceremony, but potentially with this being like a pre-filmed event, you could cut in between a bunch of different people talking about Whitney and giving a speech. There's a lot of possibility for that. But if
Do you think they're going to get Beyonce for the, I'm sorry.
I know. I mean, we kind of had thought that the Rock Hall, because Biggie was being inducted this year as well, when they were still planning the live ceremony, that like the dream would be to get Beyonce for Whitney and then Jay-Z for Biggie. Seemed appropriate.
Oh yeah. I mean, that would be obviously the dream. That would be incredible. I would love, there has to be some representation of Brandy and Monica. I just think that the way that Aretha had tapped Jennifer Hudson as like her protege for eternity. I think, you know, that is those are the two that, you know, Whitney has herself christened. But I also think that, you know, with Whitney, you've got to have that moment of a CeCe Winans or a Kim Burrell. You've got to have a little bit of a gospel element to her as well, because that's so much of what her core was. And when we're thinking about people close to her, CeCe Winans is probably, for sure, it would be my top picks. But I also, you know, producing Rock Call, and you are probably thinking of like, who is everybody watching going to know on HBO? Because that's what is also happening too. I think that gets lost. So I think that you have to, if it's not Beyonce, I don't see them being like, yeah, we're going to call Brandy. I mean, I don't think HBO, I mean, now HBO might, they might have that energy now after seeing what the numbers,
well, the numbers of verses. Yeah. Brandy and Monica are hot for like the first time in a while.
They are really very, very hot. So I think that, you know, even just that element, because we all remember like what was supposed to happen at that Clive Davis thing was Brandy and Monica was supposed to perform for Whitney. And so,
wait, what is this? I don't know.
It's why she was in Los Angeles.
Yeah, so she was there for the Clive Gala that year. Yeah, Brandy and Monica, they were going to do Boys Mine because obviously it's their classic.
Mm-hmm. And this was the pre Grammys.
The pre Grammy,
like that Clive Davis does every year.
Yeah, and so, you know, it just that moment of, you know, seeing her two girls. You know, I'll just say it that way. I think would have been really, really great. But I mean, you know, as much fantasy as there is, I like to sit in the reality of like, whoever Clive tells HBO is going to do it is what it's going to be. You know what I mean? Like, it's still, I mean, we can't get away from, and this is not at all to, I mean, I like Clive. I don't want to say that I don't like Clive. I like Clive. I don't hold any sort of, disillusioned to the fact that, like, regardless, it's going to be Clive making the decision. This is what it's going to be. So I think we'll end up with Jennifer Hudson. That's what I want, but we'll end up with Jennifer Hudson, because Jennifer Hudson is the approved voice for America and people who understand Whitney. That's the closest thing that, like, you can sell it to the producers, and like, it'll be great, but I don't think it won't have that personal connection.
Well, but there can be, so here's the thing, it can be the person who inducts, you know, so it's like, who would induct,
who gives the speech, then who performs,
like who gives the speech and who performs, and
could
so
be separate.
You can have multiple performances.
Yeah,
and this is a year where that's a distinct possibility without it being a logistical nightmare.
True. So yeah, I mean, my dream moment is Beyonce giving a speech, Brandy, Monica, you know, CeCe Winans given us a couple moments, possibly.
Okay. What songs would you have them do?
Oh, I mean, I don't want to go the obvious route. I don't really need anybody trying to do I Will Always Love You. I just don't. But I would have somebody come give us You Give the Love. Saving All My Love For You.
Saving All My Love For You would be a great, like, starter. You know, like, you begin with saving, like, you know, the appetizer is Saving All My Love For You. I'd rather be home feeling blue,
so I'm saving all my love for you.
What they really like to do, too, with these things is they like to mix... God, I really do have opinions now.
How far you've come.
It's so, so dumb. But what they like to do is they like to get some really like classic people who've been around a while. I think that we could see a CeCe Winans appearance, but I don't think she would get her own song. I think she'd come out and they would be, and the audience, if this was a real show, they'd be like, woo! She'd come out at a certain time when she would get featured. But they like to start with some class. They usually... in these tributes go, maybe this is just in my dreams, but they usually go from the beginning to the big hit. So it's like you pay homage to all the aspects of their career, and then you end with something that is either their biggest hit or something that everybody can sing on.
Like, I Want to Dance with Somebody would likely be the climax.
Yeah. And that's a good climax, you know?
Oh, yes. That's a floor filler. That's an undeniable song. I actually am glad that they're not going to cut to the audience of fucking white people grooving to I Want to Dance with Somebody, though.
But
I got to be honest.
You know, they will know it. So
that is true. They would at least know that one.
Everyone knows it. Everyone knows it.
It's true. And I don't know if they're going to have some sort of acceptance of the award. I know they would, if it were a live ceremony, they would probably have Sissy there. But I don't know if they're going to do that given just what this ceremony is going to be. Maybe there'll be some words. And then I guess the question is, you know, Whitney Houston is inducted. Now, who's next? Like, what does this open the door for future inductions, whether you're going forward or where you're going backwards?
Well, do you think fucking Chaka Khan will finally get in?
Maybe. And Chaka could be a part of the, I mean, that would be a good way to have her be a part of the induction ceremony, have it be a part, have her perform to really, I mean, because as we know, the nominating committee puts her on the ballot every year and then it doesn't seem to work. And it's maybe greasing the wheels a little bit to try and put her front and center, but.
Yeah.
You seem dubious.
No.
Garrick is like, I don't think so.
Listen, because I'm very much of the school of thought. If I'm Chaka or I'm like, y'all keep doing this to me, I don't want to come sing at your funky ass event. I'm okay. I love Whitney and she knows I love her, but don't disrespect me by having me come here to do the song that she covered of mine. I mean, I just, because that's what they're going to ask. And I just don't think that is like even appropriate. But like,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, have her do this. If you want to have Chaka involved, I would ask her to give the speech. I would ask, you know, one of the two talk at some point. I wouldn't be asking her to come up there and sing, though, because I just think that's a level of disrespect that Chaka does not deserve.
Oh, mm-hmm. And yet the hall is so disrespectful.
Oh, yeah.
The hall is very disrespectful.
The email has been sent.
Yes.
What do you think about leading I'm Every Woman for the climax? Mm-hmm.
We've got a great pitch for you. This is a great opportunity.
You're gonna love it because, like, you'll be, you know, you'll really be the queen of the performance. But we've reached out to like Ariana and Christina Aguilera. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what we're kind of hoping for. Is this something that you think that maybe you want to do, Chaka?
Also, it will rob Chaka of when she finally does get inducted of her fucking song. Like, we'll have done it already. It's why she should be being inducted this year as well. They have a lot of explaining to do. In my opinion, they have a lot of explaining to do. Because, yeah, it does. It robs Chaka of her own moment for her own damn song. And it, oh, yeah, that is, I had not assessed the shadiness of that situation.
It's shady.
And that's on me. It is shady.
It's shady. Uh-huh.
I did not like that. I don't like that. Okay. Oh, but and yet they'll ask, and I wonder. It's because it's like kind of one of those "what else are you doing" kind of moments. Yeah. We're in a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
You're not on tour. You're not out there.
And that could open the doors to interesting appearances in this entire induction special.
Well, people, one appearance I don't want is I don't want the hologram to show up. I don't want it. I don't want it.
I don't want a hologram of no one. We need to stop that.
We need to find a way to shut down the technology.
No holograms. No holograms.
And I think also with it being a pre-filmed thing, with our version of holograms, you just show a film.
Just show a clip. Yeah.
Yeah, show a clip. That's what a pre-filmed hologram is. I wonder in years to come if they will try to go back. I mean, something they should have been doing already, like Dionne Warwick is not in and has never been nominated. Mm. And there is, you know, steps along the way to Whitney that have been leaped. And, you know, Patti LaBelle too.
Oh my gosh. Okay, here we go. I have a fantasy. It goes like this. They do the Whitney back timeline. We start at Whitney, and then they go back in time, all the people that they've left out of rock history, you know, all the people that like brought us to Whitney. They just like reverse the tributary. They do it through song. And then at the
what are you describing? Are you describing what will happen at the special or what they'll induct in the coming years?
I was hoping this would be the special. And then at the end they say,
and next year, we're just going to induct all these people without a ballot.
Or they just put them all in. I don't know. I've been trying to think about how to get some reparations to the hall. And I don't know how they have so far to go. They have fucked up in such major ways. They're such insane oversight. They have to do a bunch of shit to even not even make it right, but
start to get the imbalance back towards equality.
Tilt the scale even just an ounce. You'd have to do my plan, which is all black, half female ballot next year. Everybody gets in, 30 people. Full stop. No nominations. Everybody's in. You'll do that for like the next 5 years, but with a different balancing in mind. And then you just like put a moratorium on white guys for a few years until we can get things right.
Yeah, let's revisit this theory next year when the Foo Fighters get in.
<It's> so true.
But going forward, I think my guess would be now that Whitney's in, then like Mariah is the next up.
Yeah. And is her Songwriters Hall of Fame?
Oh, yeah.
Mariah's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame?
She is.
Yeah, Mariah would be great.
Mary J.
Oh, yeah.
Mary J.
Seem like the next ones to...
They really got to break that door open for the wave of R&B post Janet, after just right after New Jack, like right at the beginning of that, because, you know, I think about like, gosh, 90, 91, 92. Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot that should start being in the conversation, but I'm actually still stuck on Shaka right now, which then makes me realize that like all these other names, y'all just not getting in. You still haven't put Shaka in there.
Yeah, the backlog is so jammed up.
The backlog is absurd.
You can't even begin to talk about like Brandy or Monica. Like that's so.
Because we're just now getting Biggie. You know what I mean? I'm just some of this. I'm like, well, we have a long way to go.
Biggie's, this was his first year eligible.
Yeah.
So yeah.
When is Beyonce eligible?
She probably won't be eligible for another 10 years.
As a solo.
Yeah, as a solo artist.
Does it have to be like the first time that you put some?
Oh yeah, they'll put Destiny in though.
I don't know about that.
They'll
put in Beyonce solo.
They'll put in Girls' Time. They'll put in Destiny. They'll put in Beyonce.
So her years in Destiny's Child doesn't count toward her eligibility?
No, because that would be Destiny's Child's eligibility.
Right.
You know, her...
I was just trying to find some little loophole. You know, she's saying...
Yeah.
I'm like, put her in.
I just thought that they would count for something.
Well, hey, guys, Whitney Houston is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That's true.
10 years too late, but it's a very, very cool thing. And that ceremony will be in... when is it? November? So we will see what happens with that. Garrick, thank you so much, Garrick, for being here and doing this. This is our first Zoom with a guest.
I'm honored.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun. I know you've got the book coming out at some point, but we won't press you to put any sort of timeline. But is there anything you want to plug, whether it's your social media or whatever? How about it?
Yeah, I am at Garrick Kennedy on Twitter and Instagram, and you can go follow my work at garrettkennedy.net if you care to go see some clips as they come, some old stuff. But you know, right now my whole life is Whitney. It's a great life.
Not a bad life.
Yeah, not a bad way to be. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at RockCallPod. You can email us rockcallpod@gmail.com. Leave us a nice review, 5 stars only on Apple Podcasts. Thank you to Mike Lloyd for the logo, Yusu Kim for the music, and thank you to Pantheon Podcasts for hosting us. I'm Joe Quazala.
I'm Kristen Stoddard.
And who cares
about the Rock Hall?
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.